Well, hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Very pleased to be with you here on The Boundless Show. A great show for you today, and one that is going to be, I think, great and thought-provoking in a sense. So later on in the show, John Thomas joins us to answer a question about a relationship that has maybe gone a little bit too far, and what does it look like to ratchet it back and bring it under a God-honoring kind of umbrella in the midst of all this. And then our culture segment, those of you who follow me on Facebook know that I talked about this when I did the interview months ago. It is with Samantha Jackal. She is an author and the wife of one of the guys in our sphere who works for Focus on the Family Australia down in our Australia office. But she has written a book called My Purple Pants. You're going to have no idea what that book is about just by the title. So you're going to have to stay and listen to the culture segment because it is an unbelievable, that's two words right there, unbelievable story. So to head into that, we're going to do a roundtable talking about the subject of grace and salvation and our own stories and how they weave into what ultimately has become our experience with Jesus Christ and the gospel and how maybe that has changed or been tweaked over the years and really how we have seen our stories as being unique as we try to share Christ with others or try to live that out through our daily lives. So we have got Thomas Voss back in the fold. Welcome, Thomas.
Hello, Hollywood.
Great to have you here.
It's always great to see you.
In a very nice, what are we calling that, teal sweater?
I have no idea. Sea teal?
No, I don't think it's sea anything. I think it's
teal.
Well,
it's not like sea foamy green. It's more blue.
It is.
But it's more of like a turquoisey.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's a good color.
You know, I try.
So, and a new friend in our sphere, Brock Eastman. Brock, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
Great to have you here. Brock is involved at times, or maybe sometimes more than he would like to admit, with our Adventures in Odyssey efforts here at Focus on the Family.
That's right. So fan for 25 years and going.
Oh, my goodness. I know you're going to have to duke Martha out for that. She's a big fan, too. Ooh.
It's true. I'm probably 25 years and going, too.
Nice.
Trivia contest. No, okay. We'll save that for another day.
I will lose.
And here is Martha directly to my right. Martha, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa.
Great to have you in the fold, as always. So, all right. Well, let's just kick this off by asking a question, and that is, do any of you, when you think of your story, it's kind of that, you know, the question that always gets asked, can you please share your testimony? What is your first thought? When that comes to mind, when you think of sharing your story and your journey to Christ and really journey post-Christ, because it's not just a one-time deal, in my opinion, what kind of comes to mind? What are some of the things? Fear, trembling, excitement?
All the above.
Okay. All right. How's that, Thomas?
Yeah, you know, it's something that becomes extremely personal to, you know, your story and who you are as a person today. And I think sometimes we maybe take them lightly. You know, I grew up in a Christian home and I was always the kid who, I don't have a very good story. People would, you know, why do I need to tell it? Nobody's going to be impacted by it. You know, I got baptized when I was 7 and yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
It wasn't until I was 21 that I realized that, oh, these perfect years were actually a lot less perfect than I thought they were. And I started recognizing some things in my own life that needed to be recognized. And, you know, Christ really kind of shuffled me through that, so to speak, and helped me kind of outline what my life really was. Mm-hmm. And since then, it's been terrific. It's been, you know, difficult and hard and crazy cool at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So
where for you did the rubber hit the road? Because obviously growing up, and I have a very similar experience, you know, everyone knew I was a Christian. I went to a public school and it was kind of like, oh, she's just a good person because whatever, she goes to church and she's a Christian. And I would try to share the gospel in my very legalistic kind of way with a good amount of passion and verbosity. But I think it was when I became a young adult and when I was in college and my faith became my own that I finally realized, oh, okay, there's maybe some aspects of failure here. There's some. So what about you?
Yeah, you know, rubber hits the road. That's an interesting analogy. Going off of that, I would say I got on the freeway when I was 17, you know, and really kind of started trying to figure it out, but I didn't make my way out of the traffic jam until I was 21.
Wow.
That is very impressive. All right.
Okay.
So yeah, when I was
4 year traffic jam, that's long.
You know what? It is long, but like I said, you don't realize you're stuck in something until you look back on it. You know, that's the norm until you realize what you were in. When I was 17, I went to a David Crowder concert. What plug for David Crowder out there? and it completely changed my life. He sang a song. I can't remember the name of it. I can remember the words, and it was, "All of my life, I've been in hiding, wishing there was someone just like you." And I had this realization of that. I'm like sitting in my office, quote unquote, and God has been in the waiting room waiting for me to open the door for him this whole time, just patiently waiting. Meanwhile, my office is a wreck, you know, and finally I let him in and he just instantly started cleaning everything up. So it was kind of that, that really spoke to me, that whole idea of he's not only am I waiting for him, he's been waiting for me. Mm-hmm. to recognize that I'm waiting for him. Mm-hmm. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then, so I thought I had dealt with all this stuff in my life. I had a really bad addiction with pornography at that point in my life. Something that had gone on in my life for almost 10 years at that point. So 8 to 17, so a little over 9. And he just came in and just really just helped me start dealing with this and clearing my life up. But it wasn't until I was 21 that I really understood the magnitude of what that addiction meant for me in my life and how it truly impacted me. And when I was 21, I was really able to move forward from that even further and start recognizing how my masculinity, me as a man, you know, respecting women, respecting others just in general, really started shaping.
That's good. All right, what about the others here?
I remember going on a missions trip when I was 18, and one of our things we had to do to prepare to go on the trip was your testimony of my life before God, how I came to God, you know, and life after. And I guess that was just the first experience of kind of looking back and thinking, oh, seeing where God has brought me and where am I headed? And I just thought that was a good exercise to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because growing up in southern Minnesota, it's kind of like it's a little bit hard to be quote the stereotypically distinctive, you know, everyone there has some kind of Christian heritage and most mm-hmm. people believe that they're Christians mm-hmm. and so it is kind of a winnowing, I think, you go through in that that period. So
and that's where I was at. I grew up in the cornfields of Illinois and a little town of 5,000 called
literally
Eureka.
In the cornfields.
Yeah, literally. And you know, I grew up in a small church of like 100 about 120 people. You know, my grandparents' parents had mortgaged their house to build the church. I mean, I was so ingrained in a Christian culture or a church community that that's all I knew. And I knew nothing else other than the Nazarene church and where I was. And I just was kind of on, I guess, cruise control. But my faith wasn't really just my own. It wasn't personalized or crafted for just me. It was so much built into my family and my heritage and just long term until college when my parents decided to take me to another church, and it really started changing my perspective on what it even meant to be a Christian or what you had to. Still had a pastor with a three-piece suit and, you know, very well-dressed congregation and Sundays and Wednesday services, but just the look at grace and what that meant for my life as opposed to just following certain steps to become a Christian, that really started to shake and kind of rock my world, I guess. And what God was really doing in my life, and even coming to Focus, was shaking up what it meant to be a Christian, in my opinion. My wife didn't have that same background. She started out Catholic, but never really had a faith that was her own until she met a friend in middle school and started going to a more mainstream Christian church. And so she never had that judgmental set mindset maybe that I had. I didn't even realize I had it, and it was really hard. I mean, really hard to find that church because I was walking in the door and like, oh, okay, we're done after the service. Because I mm-hmm. knew right away from the people. And the church I go to now, pastor wears jeans, and now I wear jeans at church. I mean, I realize that is not what it means to be a Christian. So in just 2.5
Shocking.
Years, my perspective has changed so much on what it means to be a Christian and just to show love to others. It's changing for me. So it's
pretty
cool.
Well, so obviously we all, and you know, a lot of people know my experience kind of very similar to what's been said here in pieces. But obviously, you know, Thomas, you talk about, you know, this age of 21 and kind of getting through that 4-year period, and Brock obviously moving to churches and then getting married and coming out here and that being a game changer. And Martha and I, we were both in Christian homes. And what was there ever a point then where finally you got out of the Sunday, Wednesday, Sunday, 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 Thursday services, and you're like, oh, there are actually people that believe and think differently than I do. How in the world am I going to relate to them? Because it's all well and good when you're all reading the same Christian magazines and doing the Sunday school right. curriculums and talking the language and the, you know, understanding the game. But what do you have a recollection of remembering what it was like to be, wow, I'm now small fish, big pond, and I need to somehow articulate what I believe and what this means?
You know, I think I'm still figuring out some of that, but conversation with my wife, with Ashley, just talking about what it means to be the godly leader of the house. I struggle with that at times, meaning that leading us in doing a devotional together, reading our Bibles together, reminding her of that. You know, I take it for granted what it means to be a Christian, so I'm still learning to actually take the initiative on leading my family strong and my kids. I have two little girls. And so I think having my own family has really changed and made me realize what that means. So getting out that comfort box, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I remember my first job out of college, a Christian college, was at a secular newspaper, and there was a Jewish guy there and a Lutheran and I think one girl that never went to church, period. And it was so eye-opening to me of like, holy cow, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think it strengthened, you know, my own faith of like, okay, like I need to be a light in this situation. And there was different situations where it was a little awkward, but yeah, I look back at it as a growing time.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you had like kind of the knowledge you needed to speak to those people about their perspectives and their beliefs, like from growing up in a church? Because like when I grew up, I think that was one challenge I had. I realized they had this place I worked, these Mormons would come by, and the guy who owned the business would always, he wasn't afraid to invite them in and talk to them. But I'm like, I don't know how to answer that question. And so growing up in the church, I didn't really dig into what the answers were as much as I have had to now. And so I just didn't know if that was something you faced in the workplace.
I don't know if we talked too much about beliefs, but just lifestyles were so different. I mean, they would ask to go out for drinks after work or something. And really at the time, I don't know if I was pretty young, but I just didn't go. Other people might say, go and build the relationship, but yeah, that's another topic.
Yeah. You know, for me, you know, you talk about going to 15 different churches, Brock and stuff, and I wasn't necessarily in the same boat. I would have liked to have put myself in that boat. I've talked here before about the church I'm at now is so different and so diverse from the one I grew up in, you know, the Bible Belt of Oklahoma, where the norm was, where do you go to church? It wasn't, do you go to church? You know, I mean,
right.
That was just what you did. And I went to a church that everyone was like me. You know, they were all suburbanites, you know, who drove their 16 different cars and came to church on Sundays. And the church I'm at now is so economically, social, ethnic, just completely diverse in every aspect of the word. And it really terrified me at the beginning because I don't have a place here. Where am I going to find my niche? And I realized I was asking myself the wrong questions. It should have been, you know, how are these people, how am I going to learn from them? What are they going to learn from me? Moving forward, and I talk about now really feeling a calling to the church as opposed to finding a church that fit my needs, mm-hmm. quote unquote. And so it's been really interesting. On the other hand as well, I have this diverse group of friends here. You know, I'm in the theater scene and I've spoken about that before as well. And so I've got these crazy, cool, on fire for the Lord Christians as friends. And then I've got, I hate religion, but I love you, Thomas, friends. And so how do I relate to both parties and stay true to who I am as a Christian and who I am as Thomas? And the one thing I found extremely helpful, and you look at Christ and he did this all the time, was just coming to them on their level, regardless of what you believe or regardless of what you're going to do after work or, you know, before a show. You are just people coming together as people, just trying to live together. And I think Christ exemplified that perfectly, you know, by going to people's house to have dinner with them, inviting, you know, Nicodemus down out of the tree to get to know him and stuff. And so I may not, you know, want to go drink with them at the club and stuff, but I'm more than willing to ask them, oh, hey, let's go for coffee instead, maybe, you know,
right.
Let's do something else instead. I am one of the people who doesn't have a problem going to the bar with them and stuff as well, but it's taken me a long time to get to a place where I'd be comfortable with that. So for me, it's been this beautiful, I hate this word, but I feel like it really fits here, organic ride to just develop relationships with people. And first and foremost, just get to know who they are. And I find them starting asking questions about my faith as it goes from there. So it's been really, really great. So mm-hmm. challenging, but great.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's because of, you know, anyone can jump in here, that getting to know you and feeling, recognizing that there is something different, and then how do they posit kind of questions towards you? What does that look like?
Yeah. You know, I'm not shy about my faith, and they all are very aware of it. You know, definitely in the theater, It takes me a couple of weeks before I tell them I work at Focus on the Family, especially here. For all of you guys out there, Colorado Springs is really mixed. It's either you love Focus or you hate Focus. You know, you'll never find anyone who's in between. And a lot of my friends hate Focus. So I'm normally hesitant at first, but when it comes out, I'm very open about talking about it with them. And then I invite them to church. I've invited more people to church than I can remember, and I've actually had people come with me, and it's been awesome. Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed the experience. You know, most of them walk away with a new agey approach of, you know, oh, your pastor's a really good teacher, and, you know, everyone has just really good spirits there. But that's fine. You know, if they're taking away at least that, then they know it wasn't this hateful place that they've been told it was. And so I encourage them to ask me questions, but a lot of the times I have to step up, and it's normally through my actions and things I say, like, you know, they all wanted to go to a certain club, and it's known as a gay club, and I just told them I would be more than willing to go out with you guys, but I won't go there. Mm-hmm. You know, and they asked me, why won't you go there? And I told them. And it was really interesting. I had a friend who is gay himself, and he actually stood up for me and was encouraging me. You know, he's the one who told me it was a gay club. He's like, I want you to go hang out with us, but I won't let you go there. You know, he's actually protecting me at that point, because he knows where I stand and what I believe in because of the relationship we've built. So it's definitely through actions and words, then they start asking questions, but I'm never shy about encouraging them as well. Mm-hmm. I get extremely nervous, but, but you know, I always think that God is going to speak through me, and he always comes through for me. So.
So as you all have kind of grown in your faith, and obviously it's become more than just something that you grew up with and something you learned about in church and something you walked the aisle for, or whatever your experience was, how has just experience through, whether it's struggles with sin or struggles with, you know, recognizing, I was just in a conversation this weekend with a couple, and one thing she said, you know, I didn't realize how selfish I was until I got married, and I didn't realize how angry I was until I had kids. And she was just talking about how external things have caused her to realize how much she really needs God's grace and how much she really does need to apply the gospel to her life every day. And have you guys had any game-changing moments where you've realized, here's something I wasn't prepared for? Maybe, you know, this in life hit me, or this is something where I've had to reevaluate my faith through a certain lens and kind of, you know, shape who I am in light of that.
You know, for me, it's really interesting. You always hear whenever you're growing up in Sunday school, you know, God knows not only what you're doing around other people, God knows what you're doing by yourself as well. And I've lived on my own for about a year and a half now. And whenever you're by yourself and you're bored, for me specifically with my past struggles with pornography, that has really come up. It's, you know, oh, no one's here. I can just do whatever I want. And so how do I applicably, you know, take what God tells us in the word and apply that to my life and you know, keep strength in that, because no one is watching. I have to hold myself accountable in this, you know, and all through the Gospels, there's a verse that talks about, you know, if your hand causes you to sin, then cut it off. And I tried to really figure out, how does that look in today's society? Mm-hmm. So at my house,
because you still have both your hands.
Because I still have both my hands, right? You know, you always get scared. I don't want to cut off my hands. You know, Jesus, that's great, but it's not applicable now. Well,
thanks for that theology.
Well, you know, yes, I'm the best theologian you'll ever meet. So I don't have internet at my house. You know, if I think porn is going to cause me to stumble, I don't need the internet at my house. Why would I need it? You know, I have a K9, it's called K9 web search filter on my phone. I'm not plugging any specific filter, but it doesn't allow me to access anything. You know, Google announced that they're going to start a porn channel now. I mean, it's just becoming completely saturated in the market. And so I can do everything possible as a single man to quote unquote cut my hand off from causing me to sin. You know, when I got my DirecTV, they offered 3 months of HBO and Cinemax for free. I literally called and almost had to argue with the lady to be like, I don't want the promo. I don't want the 3 months. Oh, well, it's free. Just take it off, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had to tell her exactly why. Mm-hmm. You know, you have these moments where you're called, you know what? I have to tell you why I don't want HBO and Cinemax. Mm-hmm. And you're a complete stranger on the phone, but I have to be okay with that.
That's an opportunity too, though, that God's literally giving you in your hands as a witness opportunity, because you don't know what they're struggling with on their end of the line too. That's actually pretty cool. So.
Yeah. So anyways, so that's just one way, you know, to take something, you know, every single day I get up and, you know, I've just, instead of, you know, one, I give it over to the Lord, and two, I've taken steps to eliminate it from my life. Mm-hmm. Even if I wanted to do something like that, then I don't have the chance to. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, for me, I think judgment has been my biggest thing, is to get over this hurdle of judging others. And so it's something I still struggle with. But, you know, I have a wife who, again, I mentioned her, but she is like my foundation. And so it's just nice to have somebody else who I'll mention something to her. Oh, did you see that? And she'll be like, honey, that's, you know, that you're judging them. And we'll say, she'll say it in private. She doesn't call me out in public in some way, but she reminds me. And so it's just helpful for me to start looking at that. And I've come a long way from not, you know, accepting from others what they give. People have so much to give to you, realizing that, wow, this is a person, they have so much to offer.
Right.
And so that's been something for me to learn. But
I think a game changer for me was back when I was 16 and going to a youth conference and seeing all these other teenagers, you know, excited about God. And really, that was the point where I took ownership of my faith, you know, instead of just relying on my parents of they do it, so I'll do it kind of a thing. And I think that set the foundation for moving forward of choosing to go to a church, even in college where nobody's really paying attention to what you're doing. And even I live alone as well, Thomas, and it's your own accountability of like, I'm going to get up and I'm going to do this and I'm going to serve in this way and just really making it my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I've had a number of different things and just getting involved in, it's funny, Martha, I had a similar story with when I worked at the Washington Times out in D.C., just being in a pool of folks where I was, even though it's a relatively conservative paper and I was on their magazine, I was considered the church lady. That's what I was called. And I was always the one who, I don't know, well, ask the church lady or she'll know or she'll, you know, and so it was just kind of a weird thing. But to really start loving people and to include them in my sphere and to not have just my, here's what I do with church and here's what I do with my family and here's what I do with these friends. And then here's where I'm going to, you know, what I'm going to talk about with these folks, but to really open up my life. And I know around the time of my dad's death, that was a pivotal point with one of my non-Christian friends. And I've maybe shared this before, but she was she asked me one day if we could go out to lunch so she could hear how I got through my dad's death, because she noticed such a peace in my, just in my countenance and in my heart. And of course, being the super spiritual person that I am, my first reaction was, you have got to be kidding me. How many times have I shared the gospel with this woman and she has not responded? And now it's this that is attracting her to Christ. You know, here I was like, I have shared very compellingly with many anecdotes and related illustrations as to why she should become a believer.
So I just had this pride,
you know, rise up in me, and you know how I felt that, you know, she should have listened before. And but we had just such great conversations in the wake of that. And I think for me, I had read, Martha and I were talking yesterday, and I read Jerry Bridges' book, The Gospel for Real Life, and I referenced that earlier, but it really walks through what grace looks like throughout Scripture in the Old and New Testaments. And when they really did, you know, send that goat out into the wilderness and then they sacrificed another one, what does that actually mean? It actually means that our sins are cut off and our sins are sent away to be remembered no more. And what, right. You know, and to apply that to my life and realize that, you know, there are reasons why people go to bars, Thomas. There are reasons why people want to go there and sit there and be known and talk to people who are just as screwed up as they are so that they can feel like, you know, they have someone in it with them. And I think we lose out on opportunities in the church when we kind of, you know, say, well, you know, definitely come and do this with us, but make sure that you're dressed okay and that you, you know, at least clean up your act. You know, don't be drunk. You know, don't be, you know, don't just get yourself together and then let's come and talk about this. And
I think that's also one of the things that dealing with is that in the church, often we grow up thinking we have to have this perfect look and perfect feel. Mm-hmm. And that's part of that khakis and dress shirt I was talking about. And, you know, my wife didn't have that. She's very open on what that, you know, if she has a struggle, she puts it out there and she asks for, you know, prayer and things like that. And the church I'm at now, a lot of people, they put that out there. They are putting their lives. We had a married small group we go to, and some of the struggles these married couples are talking about, the first time we met, I'm just like, I was so uncomfortable because I'm used to everybody having these perfect facades of what their life looks like. And so it started to bring down those barriers for me too, to be a little more open. I'm not that open yet, but you know, just working on that, because we do have this perfect picture of what a Christian sometimes can be. And God's really hitting that in my life a lot to bring that down.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's so funny, because when I always talk about waiting in the waiting room, you know, but the reality of it was, is I was trying to get myself perfect to present myself to the Lord before I could truly come to him. And he calls us to come as we are, you know, shambles and all, you know, that's when he can do his best work. And so it took me to realize I need to be okay with XYZ in my life. And I need to be open about XYZ in my life, because until I am, he's not gonna be able to do anything about it, because I have to first admit it to him in order for him to do his work. And so that's, you know, when I encourage my friends to come to church with me and stuff, they're like, what do I need to win? I'm like, Come as you are. You know, I mean, if you want to come in your makeup and your stilettos, then but so be it. You know, I will stand by your side and give you a hug in front of all those people as well, because that's exactly how Christ sees you and wants to see you. You
know, that's the coolest thing to learn.
Know, yeah, how you are, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Well, thanks everyone for weighing in on this conversation. I think it's good. And like I said on the front end of the show, I want to encourage everyone to stay tuned and listen to Samantha Jackal's story as she tells it. A great example of someone who really felt that she was close to God and felt that she had it. I mean, despite a horrible upbringing and just the many things she went through, did have an encounter with Christ, but it didn't mean that the road became paved. It was an extremely difficult journey for her and for her husband. So stay tuned and be encouraged and be out there and truly let the Holy Spirit do the work. And I think that's the other thing too, is step back and let who Christ is in you do the work, because it's His responsibility to draw people to Himself. So thanks everyone.
I feel like a star right out of the sky, shattered like all of my dreams. I thought I was holding the world in my hands until it brought me to my knees.
Hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I'm very privileged to be in the studio with Samantha Jackal. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Very great to have you. As you could probably tell from a little, you know, taste of the accent there, Sam is from Australia. She is up here in the States celebrating summer with us, normally her winter down there. So you're enjoying the weather?
I'm loving your weather. Yeah, I can't get so enough fun. Of that sunshine.
I know. It's great. Colorado's a great place to be for sunshine. That is for sure. So, but you are here. You actually have a book that we're going to talk about, because you were visiting a lot of folks in our international department here at Focus on the Family. Your husband, Peter, works for Focus Australia.
Yes.
And shout out to the Aussies there who listen to our show. I was telling Sam about you, so you are heard. You know that we love you. Hey. So, but he works for our office down there, and you have a book. I just, in learning of your story, I first got an email that shared that you were actually here in the office, and it gave a little synopsis of some of your story and talked about your book, and I was like, what in the world? How could this story be for real? And I got a copy of the book and was able to look through it last night and today. And you are going to tell us, Sam, a little of your story, because it's a story of God's grace. And I was telling you even before we started recording how a lot of young adults, those folks that are in our audience for the most part, will we tend to look at our stories, and there's so much brokenness really in young adults today because of divorce, the generations that have gone before us, and just a lot of, you know, and I'm sure there was in previous generations, maybe we didn't hear about it as much, but so many young adults now have grown up in situations that were less than ideal, and now are tasked, whether, you know, if they're believers, many in our audience are, with crafting their own family and going ahead from here and understanding what that looks like and what God's plan for them is in the midst of that. And I think there's a lot of heartache in that. And your story is one that literally could have been scripted as a soap opera. For here in the States. I mean, it could have, it, like I said, as I was reading, I was just like, how in the world could this have happened? And then this, and then this, and then this. But we're going to talk a little bit about that here. So let's start from the beginning, Sam. Your growing up years, give us a little bit of your background and kind of how that sets the stage for what we'll be learning as far as God being introduced into your life and what He ultimately did.
Well, I'm the youngest of four in my family. My mother wanted a boy, and I was going to save the marriage. So the minute I was born, my mum rejected me and made it very clear to my siblings, who are a lot older than me, that I was going to be a problem and that everything that happened in life was my fault. So I learned at the age of 4 and 5 how to people please, how to make situations work for the better. So I'd often fall over in front of people if there was an argument to try to, you know, bring the attention onto me to stop the conflict. And at around the age of 5, my life at home became really bad. My father was an alcoholic who was a really abusive man, and he was often locked up in the local jail prison for his violence, the domestic violence. And my mother was a really manipulative woman and had real huge issues with lying. And so around the age of 5, I decided I had had enough. And so I decided that I would run away. And so I packed a little case and ran away and bumped into a lady that was dressed in black, and she had a hat on, and it happened to be a Salvation Army lady. And she bent down and said, you know, may Jesus look after you. And at that point, my sister called me back, and I was taken home to the ridicule of my family. They all thought it was hysterical that I would try to run away. Mm-hmm. And soon after that, my mother decided to leave my father. He had planted a homemade bomb under our car and put us all in it. And the police were called, and the situation was diffused. But my mother had had enough. So she decided to move us away from that town and away from our father. And so we moved to the other side of a place in Victoria called Bensdale. So it's kind of like we went from one end of the state to the other end, as far as you could go. And moved us straight in with another man and his children. And so my mother, by that time, started to drink as well and started to show signs that, you know, life wasn't good for her. So she started turning to alcohol to, I guess, heal that void in her life, the loneliness. But she also began to turn to me to fill that void in her life. So she began to sexually abuse me, which often isn't talked about. People don't hear of that. They hear of fathers and uncles and male neighbors, but they don't actually hear about mothers. So, you know, people would ask me, were things going okay at home? And I would say yes. They would question me, was your stepfather doing anything that he shouldn't be doing? And I would say, you know, absolutely not. I loved my stepfather, or this now my stepfather, and he was such a gentle man. So life at home was really horrible. It was really like a torment being at home. And so, you know, I found no peace within the walls of my home. And at school, I met a beautiful little girl by the name of Heidi Jones, and she was from a Christian family. And so she introduced me to church and to God and to what a family looks like and what a loving family looks like. So they kind of took me under their wing, and I could call them and go and visit them. And they were like a lifeline for me. And so, yeah.
Almost like, you know, living, you had your family and the mm-hmm. life that you lived at home, but then you saw this other family in kind of another way that it could be done. And there's this person, Jesus, that was somehow infused into that situation and made it different. So yeah. You went, ultimately you ended up, it's just amazing how, you know, here was your story, you meet Heidi, and let's jump ahead here a mm-hmm. little bit, because you ultimately decide that you're going to go, you're going to do Bible school.
Yeah.
And so through that, you again are introduced to a family, and you see a certain photo, I know,
yes.
that you were taken with. So tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that.
Well, I did. I think when I decided to go to Bible school, it was kind of my way of escaping. It was for 3 months and I wanted out, and so that was my way of getting out of under my mum's control. So I stayed with a family in another state in Australia called New South Wales, and on their mantelpiece above their fireplace, they had this photograph, and inside in the photo was this young man, and I looked at it and thought, I'm going to marry you. You know, he just was a gorgeous looking guy. Mm-hmm. And I asked them who it was and where he came from, and they said, you know, he was from New South Wales. His name was Peter. And so I didn't know how, but I thought, I think I'm going to marry him. And so I kind of kept that in my heart, that little, like, yep, one day I'll marry that guy.
Yeah. Which is so cute. I mean, it's cute to look back on that now and see that story and how it unfolded. But of course, a lot more took place in mm-hmm. between there. So let's continue the story a little bit in your meeting him and kind of what happened in the process there.
Yeah, well, I eventually went back home after Bible school and made my way out of my, moved back in with my mother, and then was suggested that I move out, and I did. And I eventually made my way to Melbourne because we were in a country town and Melbourne was the city. So I moved up to Melbourne and attended a church, and it just happened that Peter had moved down to Melbourne and was attending that church. So the minute I saw him, I knew who he was. And we started a friendship, a great friendship that was, you know, really healthy. It was a good friendship. We would go out and chat and just got along really well. And that friendship eventually turned into a relationship. And one night he proposed to me and I accepted his proposal to get married. And from there, the past or my past started to show, and I had cracks in my personality that I couldn't hide anymore. And they started to come out, and Peter started to see them and started getting worried and thinking, you know, this girl isn't actually who I thought she was. Yeah. She has issues.
Well, and it wasn't, you know, here at Boundless, we talk a lot about relationships and what it looks like to move forward biblically in dating, and what good boundaries are, and all of that. And Peter was a believer and was even involved on the music team at church and doing, you know, doing a lot of that, and had a good core group of friends. And now you were kind of introduced into the picture. But I think it's important to say, you know, even your dating relationship wasn't smooth sailing entirely. A lot of that because of your own insecurities and your story, and probably some missteps on his part too, because the relationship kind of became physical, and there was, you know, you started bringing in some of the manipulation as well. And so looking back on that now, you know, especially knowing young adults and where they are today, I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot that plays into that as well, when we think, well, we're just going to take this into our own hands and, you know, do what we need to do to get the person we want, or do do that. I mean, how do you see your own story reflecting that?
Absolutely. Well, once Peter called off the engagement, which is what he did, you know, I certainly, there was no boundaries then. I just wanted him back. And yeah, I pushed every boundary there was. I lied. I did all kinds of conniving things to get his attention, until eventually he noticed me again. And then our relationship.
Even telling him you had cancer.
Yeah, I told him I had cancer. I was out of control.
Yeah.
I wanted to be loved. And I was looking for a physical love. I wanted to be accepted, and I couldn't get that from anywhere, and I didn't know how to get it. And so anything would do. So I would just play all kinds of tricks. I even told him I was a singer, you know, a famous singer. And so,
and
you know,
produced a tape for him to listen to.
Yeah, that's right. And he would listen to it and say, man, your voice is very different to what's on the tape. You know, I hadn't thought through it quite that well.
Yeah.
But eventually we actually, our relationship turned into a sexual one. And I guess for Peter, he would say, don't push the boundaries if you don't know what you're getting. Because as soon as we fell sexually in our relationship, I definitely wanted him. There was no way he was going to walk away now. And so I told him I was pregnant. I told our leadership of the church that I was pregnant. I told him I was pregnant. And then it was, he decided he needed to marry me. That was the decent thing to do, you know. He had a relationship with me, and now he had slept with me. He needed to marry me.
And I love how, I'm just interrupting here quickly, but I love how in the book, Sam, you convey your complete cluelessness in the midst of all this. Like, you didn't even know. You were talking to nurses saying, what should I even be looking for? What, you know, you were convinced for a while that you were pregnant.
I had convinced myself.
You were just hoping.
Absolutely. I wanted so desperately to be pregnant. And to tell you the truth, I, even though I had been sexually abused, I had just shut down. So I didn't even really know about sex. That was, to me, you know, something I didn't want to talk about. And the thing I had held sacred was, if I kissed a boy, I was going to marry him, because no one had touched my lips. It was my only sacred thing I had was my lips. And so I, as the minute Peter kissed me, it was like, well, you're it. You have to marry me now. And so when I told him I was pregnant, you know, I was going and getting blood tests. I was, you know, and they would say, no, you're not. And I would go back to another doctor in another suburb and say, you know, I need a blood test, I'm pregnant. And one doctor even looked at me and said, have you even had sex? And I was like, yes. You know, they could see that something wasn't adding up. And especially I would go much more as the date was drawing close for our marriage. You know, we had given ourselves a 3-month span to get married. And so the closer it came, the more I realized that my stomach wasn't growing, that, you know, he was going to find out. What was I going to do? How was I going to get out of this? Mm. You know, I couldn't tell him because then he wouldn't marry me. And so 3 weeks before our marriage, I told him I miscarried our baby. And he was just devastated. I've never seen a man, he was 23, cry so much. You know, he curled up in a ball in the corner of the house and just wept and wept and wept. And I began to weep as well. But I was weeping because I was worried I was going to lose him. Mm-hmm. Where he was weeping because he just felt so trapped. And he felt like he had just messed up his life completely. You know, he had a relationship with a girl with lots of issues. Mm-hmm. He got her pregnant. Now she's miscarried. What does he do?
Yeah. And you had woven kind of such a web of lies. You were trying to keep them all in order. I mean, you could hardly, you know, from what, and like you said, you know, finally you had to say you miscarried because the truth of that was ultimately going to come out. So, so you did marry and then you settled in, you know, loosely stating, I guess, into married life and your place and, but had a rocky start for sure.
Absolutely. You can't hide your past for, you know, forever. And so I was insecure because I knew how Peter married me. You know, he married me because I was pregnant, you know. He was just being loyal that he carried through. So I was really insecure. So he would go off to church and music practice, and I would accuse him of going and having an affair, or I would accuse him of loving God more than me, you know. Mm-hmm. I would just be throwing arguments at him all the time. You know, I was argumentative. He would come home and I would just start arguing with him, you know, about anything. Mm-hmm. If it was about the way he shut the door or the fact he didn't greet me. Mm-hmm. And so we'd have these massive arguments to around 2 a.m. in the morning. And to tell you the truth, I was out of control. I had no idea how not to argue or how not to be cross with him, because I so desperately wanted to be loved. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't love me the way I wanted to be loved. And I was starving, you know, for this love that would replace what I didn't have as a child. So these arguments went on for 9 months where, you know, I'd be up till 2 a.m. I would walk out of the house, I'd slam the door, and I'd hide in a bush down below and make him kind of just sit there and think about what had gone on. Mm-hmm. Make him pay. Mm-hmm. And then I'd walk up and, you know, he would apologize and, we're going to be okay, Sam. I know we'll get through this. And then eventually one day he said to me, Sam, I am emotionally ruined. Mm. I can't do this any longer. So I, you know, the only thing I can see is we need to separate because I just don't think I can cope. And that just sent me into a massive panic attack. There was no way he was leaving. Mm-hmm. What could I do? How was I going to get out of this? You know, what could I say?
Mm-hmm. And up to this point, you still hadn't told the truth about the pregnancy.
No.
And so you had one day, you decided that you were actually going to talk to someone about it. You were going to go to the elders at church and talk.
Yeah.
And he ended up coming. And tell us, that was a pivotal moment in truth-telling.
Yeah. Look, and to tell you the truth, I had planned it in my mind that it was going to be like, you know, a prince on a white horse kind of scenario. I'd tell the truth and he would come and grab me and hold me and tell me how much he loved me and it would all be better. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that's not the way it worked. So I had organized for my leaders to tell them, and then I had organized for Peter to come and I would tell him. And so I had it all worked out. It was going to work perfectly. And so I told my leader and he was in shock, like, oh my goodness, you know, what do we do? And Peter came and I told Peter, and as I got the words out, I never was pregnant. I never miscarried. He got up off his seat and walked out the front door of the house, slammed it shut, and I didn't see him again for 9 months. Hmm. So he was just devastated. He was like, you know, I can't believe this. You know, who does this kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he was just in turmoil. So he left and went and lived with friends. And he started to seek God and ask God, what do I do with this situation? And meanwhile, no one knew what to do with me. Mm. And so you got to imagine that this poor church had never come across anyone that had done anything like this. And so they kind of suggested maybe I should take a break from church and from our friends and let Peter have the church and the friends to support him and go and join somewhere else. And so now I felt abandoned by the church. So in my mind, God had abandoned me. You know, not only had Peter, but now God. So for me, I started to fall apart even more. I was holding down a job 4 hours a night, and I would go there with black eyes. I started to really self-harm badly, which I'd learned as a young kid. I had learned that the way to get my anger out at home was to pull my hair or to hit myself or, you know, to be able to abuse myself in areas where people couldn't see. And so I started to do that more and more during those 9 months. And I'd have great stories, you know, I've walked into a door or someone accidentally hit me or, you know, and everyone believed me. I was quite good at convincing them. And so no one questioned me where all the bruises were coming from or where the cuts on my face were coming from. And then eventually I started to really feel like I was schizophrenic because I just didn't know if I was coming or going or what life was. You know, I was just a wreck. I was just falling apart.
Yeah. And that's really where the story continues. And I like how there's a portion of the book where Peter tells that situation from his own perspective. And he walks back into the scenario that you've just told and talks about storming out, you know, after that meeting and wandering the streets and then figuring out where he was going to go and finding the friends and really wrestling with God for months over that and figuring, you know, wondering, how did I get into this situation, how am I going to get out of it, was one of his first one of his first thoughts. But God spoke to him through his scripture, and so go ahead and pick it up from there.
Look, God did speak to him. He was completely ready for a divorce, and he had been advised that he could get a divorce and it was a good thing to do. And one day he was praying and he felt the Lord lead him to Joshua 9. And I'll paraphrase what that says. It was Joshua had made a treaty, a promise with the Gideonites under deception. And when Joshua found out that he had made this promise, that it was under deception, he went and sought God. And God said, well, actually, Joshua, you never actually sought my advice before making that promise. So I want you to fulfill the promise. You know, you need to keep it. And that really spoke to Peter. Like, I never did, you know, Peter would say, I never did consult with God before marrying you. I just did it. And so he came back and said, Sam, I feel like I'm led to come back. I don't love you. I'm going to come back and I'm going to pray. And I'm going to ask God to show me what he wants me to do in our marriage. I know I'm meant to be here. I have made a vow before God. And you've got to imagine, this is a 23-year-old. Yeah. So it's not a 30 or 40-year-old. This is a 23-year-old. And he said, you know, I really feel that the Lord has told me I need to keep my vow before him to you. So I'm moving back in and I'm going to move back into our spare room. And I'm going to fast and pray for you and for our marriage. And trust God will heal it.
So we would think that the story is over there and it's just a happy ending and, oh my goodness, your relationship is restored and you just saw the love of Christ in him and you eventually were able to both return to church together. But there was still more ahead. And I, you know, really an understanding now as you were living together again and, you know, really you started spending time in prayer. You were in different rooms.
Yeah.
It really was kind of a starting at ground zero and really moving that ahead and rediscovering one another, getting to know one another again. But in the midst of that, I know you said there was still more that happened. So go ahead and tell us.
Yeah, look, I had to go and get counseling and work through my past. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of damage there that I had brought into our marriage and into our relationship. So I really needed, you know, help through that. So, you know, I had prayer ministry, I had counseling to undo. How do you talk to someone without manipulating them? How do you talk to someone and not tell a lie? I had to relearn how to live life. And I had to also relearn how to love and what love looked like. What did it really look like? But more than that, I needed to find a foundation in Christ. Mm-hmm. I needed to go really deep with Christ. I had this kind of knowledge of him. I had this, you know, what Jesus was like. But I never really had a foundation in Christ. So we would work through scriptures, and I had to learn what it meant to be a Christian, or, you know, accept Christ into your life. What was that really about? How did it change your life? And I also needed to learn about forgiveness. And I had to go back and visit people and forgive them. And I had to visit myself in a way, you know. I talk about, you know, having to dig really deep and being able to walk in forgiveness over myself, all that I had done, all the bad things I had done. You know, I had lied to so many people, to a lot of organizations, mm-hmm. a lot of my workplace, my friends, my pastors, churches, my husband. And so I had to learn about forgiveness, but I wasn't able to learn about forgiving others and myself until I had learned about the forgiveness of Christ. Mm-hmm. And it was during that time that, you know, we were able to start our relationship, but it had to start on a good, healthy foundation. I can remember one day being in the kitchen and Peter coming in, and it's about now a year after, and I'm still working through issues. You know, there was a lot there, 18 years of abuse. So it doesn't just go away overnight. Mm-hmm. And I was standing in the kitchen and Peter came in and he said, "Sam, I've got to tell you, I don't love you." And this wave of relief came over me, like, oh, phew, because I actually don't love you either. And it was that foundation that we could start, that this honesty, that, okay, we both know where we stand, and now we have something to work off. We're not kind of trying to predict what the other one's thinking or feeling. And, you know, we have a saying in Australia, we're not walking on eggshells. You know, mm-hmm. We're not being tentative with each other. We could be honest. And after that, we started to fall in love. We started to enjoy each other's company. We started to relax around each other and get to know each other. And Peter started to understand me a little bit more and attend some of my counseling and understand where I was coming from and be able to help me through issues. And as we're now 23 years married, you know, there were still issues that I have to come by. Mm-hmm. You know, having children brought up issues for me. And so, you know, I go off and get some more counseling and help through how I work through those. Mm-hmm. And there's no shame in that. You know, if you've been abused, it's important that you remain vulnerable to those around you and vulnerable to work through them and not hide it and be ashamed. And I think a lot of people that have been abused become ashamed. Yeah. And it's important not to be, and to be able to seek help and get help through those things.
Yeah. There's one other just piece of the story I wanted mm-hmm. to touch on briefly, because we did a show not too long ago on just on spiritual warfare and mm-hmm. on the very real powers of darkness yeah. that are out there. And that was a portion of your story as well, in understanding when you were finally, you know, you were relating to Peter, you were in the throes of the jealousy and dealing with that. And you had kind of a pivotal night. I mean, not that you weren't, you know, you would often spend evenings, like you said, fighting mm-hmm. and arguing. But you had a pivotal night that really led into some very real wrestling with Satan and deliverance from that. Tell us
yeah.
about that.
So. Look, as a young kid, when I was going to church, I learned about Satan at church as well as God. And so in the desperate times, I would invite Satan into my life as well as God. I didn't care who helped me. I just wanted out. Mm. So I had opened a lot of doors to the enemy. I would beg him, you know, just come into my life and, you know, I'll do whatever you want me to do, but just get me out of this situation. And then, I'd pray to God. Wow, God, if you're stronger, you know, then you do it. But I just want help. And so this one night in particular, Peter had had enough. I had just gotten home from work. I was tired. And I don't know what came over me. I was angry at him more than ever. I actually thought I probably could kill the guy. And he was in his room and he had been fasting and praying that day for me. He had taken the day off work. And I opened up his door and I went in there and I just blasted him. I told him how hopeless he was and I didn't want him around and I was sick of him and he didn't love me. And I was angry. And I walked out, slammed his door, slammed the kitchen door as I walked into it. And I was just standing there looking over out our window over the car park. And I could feel it was like this heaviness over me. And he came in and he didn't know what to do or say. And so I spun around and I was so angry. I was just ready to throttle him, you know, to kill him. And he just said to me, "In the name of Jesus, be quiet, be silent." And I couldn't believe it. There was just this thing that rose up within me, and I just started swearing. And now I held myself proud that I would never swear. So I just started cursing him. And at that point, Peter says that a relief came over him, because now he knew what he was dealing with, that this was a spiritual battle. It wasn't just an emotional one. And up to this point, he was thinking, I'm going to have to put her into a psychiatric clinic. I don't know what to do with that.
He even said the sound of your voice was that of a man. Yeah, he said it was just a complete, your countenance completely changed.
Absolutely.
And he's battling.
And I felt that on me. I could feel this thing in me. And so that's when we started prayer ministry. He started, first of all, the first thing he said was, do you want to be free? And I had to think about that, because I knew there was going to be a lot of sacrifice if I said yes. I'd played this game long enough. And when I had said yes, he gave me a day. He then said, well, you need to learn scripture. I'm not praying for you until you have foundational scriptures and spiritual warfare scriptures. You know, you need to know where you stand with God. And that took a lot of discipline on my part. I had a lazy mind. I didn't want to do it. And he would ask me every day, have you learned that scripture? No, I haven't. Well, unless you want to help yourself, Sam, I can't do anything. God can't do anything unless you're willing to help yourself by learning scripture, to learn the foundations. So I began to learn scripture, all the spiritual warfare, what my authority in Christ was. And then we began to pray, and I was set free. And it was after that being set free that I then had to go and get counseling and start to rebuild what had been taken away. And I felt like an empty shell. I felt free, but I felt like an empty shell, because I had held on to this for a long time. You know, it kind of gave me a bit of power in my life. And so when I had released that, I then, you know, had to rebuild.
Yeah, and thus began the process of rebuilding that you were talking about in your life.
Yeah.
And now 23 years, married, five children.
Yes, yes.
As we mentioned on the front end of the show, Peter's involved with work at our Focus on the Family Australia office. Really, just as you said, was your hope, Samantha, a testimony to God's grace in the midst of all of this. What, as we close here, and I'm going to, you know, again, the book is My Purple Pants, and we're going to make you get the book in order to find out that story and how that weaves into the larger narrative of that. But looking at this, Samantha, what would you say, first of all, talking to a young adult who maybe is in some kind of bondage now, whether, you know, a very real, you know, very real spiritual battle coming from a past, maybe similar to yours. What's your advice to young adults who are struggling, and because they don't think they're loved, they don't think they have hope, and they don't think that there's a way out and that there's anyone they could talk to? What would you say to them?
Look, I think first of all, I think you need to go and seek help. Seek counseling, and be open and vulnerable. You know, there's no shame in your past, and you have to come to a place of wanting that. You're wanting freedom. And if you don't want freedom for yourself, then you're never going to be free. But if you're wanting freedom, then I think it's there. I know it's there. I mean, my life is testimony to the fact that you can have freedom from your past. And I don't think, unless you deal with all of that, you can ever go into a future that is blessed and full of freedom. And so you really need to seek out help. Go to a counselor or your church and start to talk to people and trust people with what you've got inside. And I think also, if you're in a relationship, you know, and having difficulties in the relationship, and you've come from an abusive past or a past that hasn't been good, you then need to work on you before you can expect that relationship to work. You know, Peter and I were doomed. There was no way out, you know. Our marriage really statistically should not have worked. You know, we should have been, you know, on the divorce pile. But through the grace of God, you know, he changed that. But it was hard work. He didn't just snap his fingers and it happened. I had to work hard at changing the way I acted, reacted, the way that I learned about love and what love was and what to expect from love and in a relationship.
Yeah. And so finally, just talk to us a little bit about, because I think there is that relationship thread here. And from the beginning, I was telling you how much we talk about relationships here at the Boundless Show. And many young adults, as they get older, maybe they hope to be married by a certain age, or they had this vision in their mind of what it would look like, or they've seen someone's photo on a mantle and they said, I'm going to marry him. And so far it hasn't happened. What is your encouragement to them as far as, you saw through your story what manipulation and lies and not trusting God did. How can they turn the tide of that and really learn to rest in God in the midst of that, learning from your story?
Look, I think if they need to learn to trust in God, that and in trusting in Him, seeking Him for what they can change in their own lives, what they need to deal with. You know, I often use the picture or the illustration of an onion. There's a lot of layers to an onion, and it's quite stinky. And it also produces tears. And so the more you work at that onion, unpeeling it and dealing with stuff in our own lives, the more we draw closer to God. And, you know, before entering a relationship, I would encourage all young people to work on their own, you know, on their own life, dealing with those things of the past and not taking them into a relationship. It's much harder to deal with stuff when you're in a relationship. It's much harder for me to deal with that and for Peter in a relationship than if we were separate. And I think if we can deal with stuff and learn, the more we deal with stuff, the more we trust in God, the more we know God. And he's a gentleman, you know. God's a loving gentleman. He wants the best for us, and it's learning and trusting that he knows what the best for us is. And when we can come to that place of rest in him, knowing that he cares for us more than we care for ourselves, more than anyone on this earth cares for us, we can then relax with what he gives us.
It's very true. Well, the book is My Purple Pants. The author is Samantha Jackal. I've been talking to her here, and hopefully that is an encouragement to all of you out there, especially those of you who see so much of yourself in Sam's story. I want to remind you all that we do have many, many counseling resources here at Focus on the Family, as well as at our international offices. Here at Focus, you can go to focusonthefamily.com and search under an issue or a problem, or search for advice, or just search for counseling. You can also call us at a toll-free number, 1-800, the letter A, and the word family. And we would love to put you in touch with a counselor who can ultimately give you a referral and start you really on that path to healing. So do check out the book if you get a chance. Just an amazing, amazing, compelling story, an unbelievable story, but one, as Samantha says, she has to give all the glory to God for because of its outcome and really where you are today. So Samantha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wish I knew what I'm supposed to say to you, what you're going through, but I don't know what you're feeling. Does anyone know what you're feeling right now? The future's like an enemy, and you just wish you could see, 'cause you don't know where you're going. Don't let it keep you from hoping right now. Yeah, we've all
we are opening up this week's inbox, and I have John Thomas on the phone. Hey, John.
Hey, Lisa.
Very good to have you here with us. And a good question for you today that is a little bit broad-ish. So you're going to have to really pull all of your experience and wisdom in for this one.
Oh, my. Okay, let's do it.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have a listener who says, my boyfriend and I both know that we went into our relationship the wrong way, and now we're in a rut and trying to fix things and go back. But once you've crossed the boundaries, I feel as though it is hard to go back. Do you have anything to comment on about this?
I agree with her 100%. It yeah. is really hard to go back and start fresh. And honestly, Lisa, I not to be discouraging, because I think it can be done, but I've only seen it happen with a real small percentage of dating couples. And I think the reason is because what people want to do is just sort of look at this one little sliver of their life in this area and say that we're going to go back and try to fix this. And without looking at kind of a complete overhaul of your life. And what I mean by that is that in my experience, that those who've where both individuals have experienced a real radical heart transformation, and as a result have made sweeping changes in all the areas of their lives, like the media they watch and the other relationships and the community that they hang around in and accountability and all those things, and they just become completely enthralled with Jesus, those are the ones that I see that have success in doing this, because the change has come and it's been so dramatic in their life, and they've been so touched by the Lord that they just look at each other and they want to change everything. Mm-hmm. And I think what most dating couples, why they fail in doing this, is that this is the area they look at this, they feel a little bit bad about this, and they know that it's wrong, and they know they should have done something different, and they're starting to feel a little bit convicted about this, and so they try to draw some new boundaries, and they try to, you know, do some practical things, and all that's good, and I support all of that, but they get very frustrated because they keep failing. Because what it really requires is a complete worldview overhaul. Mm-hmm. And where I see that happening is where I see couples make this. And you see this, I'm gonna shift from dating couples to married couples. You see couples who have been married, they've never known the Lord, and you know, they've never lived for the Lord, and suddenly both of them embrace the gospel and are radically transformed, and everything in their marriage changes. And you run into them, and they're completely different people. And that's where I see this working, is when a dating couple, when their individual lives are just revolutionized by Christ, and they completely change everything. They get accountability in their lives, and they make all these dramatic changes. Mm-hmm. But if you say, well, we're going to keep everything else the same that we do, but we're going to try to go in and reset what we do from a purity standpoint in our relationship, I don't think it's going to work. I just don't think it'll happen. So what my advice is look into your total life and see where you need to embrace the Lord in every area, and then I think you'll have success in this area, because it'll be one part of a lot of parts.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, in reading this, we don't know whether they are believers or not, or what the situation is. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, is she saying, well, I still don't even know if I want to move towards marriage with this guy, which is another game changer. I mean, they're going to have to evaluate, you know, where is this relationship going, and take it seriously, because, you know, they have some decisions to make, I guess.
They do, and you're exactly right. And to some degree, whether they're believers or not, they still need a major overhaul if mm-hmm. they want this to work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If they want to reset the dial, and if they want the relationship to have a rebirth, this is really what we're seeking, then their lives need a rebirth.
Right.
And if they already know the Lord and they're born again, then they need to, you know, they need to seek him in a way like they haven't ever before. That's where I see this work. So it can work. And anyone else listening wondering, well, how could this ever work? It can work. It just takes a revolution of your lives.
Yeah.
And then I see it working. And then all those practical things do come in, you know, where you set boundaries and you're not together in private and dark, lonely places and all those things that we need to do. But if you just do those things, you'll have a little success in the beginning. But the flesh is so strong, it just wants to default back to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, John, for weighing in on this. I think that's good, and good to differentiate there, you know, what really is necessary, not just the practical, not just the surfacey kind of action items, but really revolutionizing the hearts and looking at that. So thanks.
You bet.
Okay, that is it for this week's show. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. And this week, we actually need to tell you about, or remind you about, because you should have already heard about it, our 200th episode contest. If you can believe it, we are coming up on our 200th episode, and we're doing a video contest. So go to the blog, and Martha blogged about this. You can get the contest rules there. You can get the full scoop on what this involves. We have some runner-up prizes, as well as a grand prize that includes a $200 Visa gift card and being featured on the show, as well as having your video featured on our website. And make sure that you create a video 2 to 3 minutes long that really helps us commemorate 200 episodes. So what's impacted you, what's been fun, what you've learned, anything that you want to do creatively to showcase that. So that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.